Good morning and welcome to the Monday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. President Trump loves coal so much, it's starting to annoy the oil and gas industry. By Justin Warland. Donald Trump's love for coal is hardly secret. As a candidate, he promised to make coal great again and end a supposed war on coal from Obama-era regulations that favored natural gas and renewables. At first, electric utilities and the oil and gas industry were supportive, seeing the deregulation as an opportunity for them, too. But in recent weeks, concern has grown that the Trump administration may be going too far with two proposals: a rule propping up coal suggested by the Department of Energy last week, and the proposal to repeal the Clean Power Plan without a replacement, which leaked to the press this week. At the heart of the dispute is the reality that the Trump administration can't simply bring back the coal industry by undoing regulations. The coal industry has been sick for a while, says Brendan Collins, an environmental lawyer at the firm Ballard Spahr. The thermal coal industry is much closer to needing Dr. Frankenstein services than a general practitioner services. But tipping the scale in favor of coal means hurting the oil and gas industry, which competes with coal as a source of electricity. That in part explains why a proposal introduced last week by Energy Secretary Rick Perry received swift condemnation across the board. In a letter, Perry called for new regulation to ensure companies operating power plants that can store 90 days of fuel on site, essentially coal-fired and nuclear power plants, receive payment for the electricity they produce, even if it's too expensive to compete in the open market. Perry framed the issue as a national security issue that will keep the electric grid up and running in the event of severe weather events or national emergencies. But many outside experts believe that argument falls flat and amounts to direct government intervention in the market. John Wellinghoff, who chaired the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, said the move would blow the market up, according to a Utility Dive report. Ultimately, FERC, an independent federal agency with oversight authority over U.S. electric, will decide, and observers already see skepticism in the agency's initial response. The groups that have criticized it include many of the most prominent energy trade groups outside of the coal sector, including the American Council on Renewable Energy, which represents renewable energy providers, the American Petroleum Institute, which represents the oil and gas industry, and the American Public Power Association, which represents utilities. The battle lines are being drawn, says Mark Dyson, a researcher who studies the electricity grid at the Rocky Mountain Institute. It's pretty clear who this would advantage. The effort builds on another attempt by Perry to aid the coal industry with a study evaluating whether the rapid deployment of renewables and natural gas pose a threat to the grid. By most analyses of the final document, the study shows that they do not, but Perry has since suggested otherwise. Meanwhile, on the other side of the National Mall, Trump's Environmental Protection Agency is expected to announce a repeal of the Clean Power Plan, an Obama-era measure that would have fought climate change by pushing coal out of the power sector as soon as this week without introducing a replacement. Trump's order to reevaluate the rule earlier this year was met with widespread approval by utilities and energy companies, with the obvious exception of renewables like wind and solar. But some utility companies remain concerned that the administration has no specific plan to replace it. The Supreme Court has previously found that the EPA must regulate carbon dioxide to address climate change, and repealing the Clean Power Plan without a replacement adds significant uncertainty in an industry where investments made today need to last decades. As EPA moves to repeal the current Clean Power Plan, we have been supportive of the need to also move forward with a replacement rule, said Jeff Ostermeyer, spokesman for the Edison Electric Institute, according to a report in The Hill. Ultimately, however, skepticism remains about whether any of Trump's moves can actually move the market. Data from the Energy Information Administration shows the Clean Power Plan repeal stopping a massive decline in electricity from coal-fired power plants, but not reversing the last decades of losses for the industry. Indeed, on the other side, coal industry leaders have praised the administration's moves on their behalf, but demand more. In particular, many have called on EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt to take on the endangerment finding, the scientific document that underpins the agency's carbon dioxide regulation. In the environment space and the energy space, the administration has found that its promises are hard to keep, says Collins. They require much more investment and homework than the administration has invested thus far. That investment may be yet to come. Here are the cities that celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day instead of Columbus Day. By Jennifer Kalfas. Each year, more cities, states, and universities opt to celebrate an alternative to Columbus Day, Indigenous Peoples Day. Instead of honoring Christopher Columbus, the Indigenous Peoples Day recognizes Native Americans who were the first inhabitants of the land that later became the United States of America. Advocates for the switch to Indigenous Peoples Day argue that Columbus did not discover America in 1492, but instead began the colonization of it. For decades, Native American activists have advocated abolishing Columbus Day, which became a federal holiday in 1937. This year, both Indigenous Peoples Day and Columbus Day are on Monday, October 9th. While the United Nations declared August 9th as International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples in late 1994, Berkeley, California had already become the first city in the U.S. to replace Columbus Day itself. The city's decision was influenced by the First Continental Conference on 500 Years of Indian Resistance in Quito, Ecuador in 1990, which spurred another Northern California conference that discussed similar issues and brought them to the Berkeley City Council, Time has reported. With the exception of Santa Cruz, California, and the state of South Dakota, which adopted the similar Native American Day in place of Columbus Day in 1990, the cities, states, and universities that have chosen to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day instead have done so only recently, with cities like Minneapolis and Seattle voting to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day instead in 2014. Which cities and states celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day? The states are Minnesota, Vermont, Alaska, and South Dakota. And the cities? Los Angeles County, Berkeley, California, Santa Cruz, California, San Fernando, California, Burbank, California, Long Beach, California, San Luis Obispo, California, Watsonville, California, Seattle, Olympia, Washington, Spokane, Washington, Bainbridge Island, Washington, Minneapolis, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, St. Paul, Minnesota, Denver, Durango, Colorado, Boulder, Colorado, Phoenix, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Traverse City, Michigan, Alpena, Michigan, East Lansing, Michigan, Ypsilanti, Michigan, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Santa Fe, Portland, Eugene, Oregon, Newstead, New York, the Village of Lewiston, New York, Ithaca, New York, Anadarko, Oklahoma, Norman, Oklahoma, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Tahlequah, Oklahoma, Carrboro, North Carolina, Asheville, North Carolina, Belfast, Maine, Bangor, Maine, Orono, Maine, Brunswick, Maine, Portland, Maine, Bexar County, Texas, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Amherst, Massachusetts, Northampton, Massachusetts, Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, Lawrence, Kansas, Davenport, Iowa, Durham, New Hampshire, Moscow, Idaho, Oberlin, Ohio, Salt Lake City, and Austin, Texas. And the universities? Minnesota State University, Mankato, University of Utah, and Brown University. Why is Columbus Day so controversial now? Critics of Columbus Day argue that the holiday does not celebrate the discovery of America, but instead honors the mass genocide and colonization of the people indigenous to the land. Columbus was one of the first Europeans to get to the American continent, but there was a lot of history that came after in terms of the wiping out of native people. Lonnie Hancock, the mayor of Berkeley in 1992 and former California state senator, told Time in 2014, "It just didn't seem appropriate. It seemed like a re-emphasizing of history, and recognizing that to be very ethnocentric really diminishes us all." What cities are considering celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day instead? Several other cities are considering an alternative to Columbus Day, replacing celebrations of Columbus with that of Indigenous people. A member of Washington, D.C.'s City Council proposed a bill to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day, and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio created a commission to assess the value of monuments of historical figures in public spaces in the city. That includes the monument honoring the Italian explorer in Columbus Circle near Central Park. Just days before the 2017 holiday, the City Council in Austin, Texas, voted to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. The town of New Castle, Maine, is considering a change to follow the lead of a number of other cities in the state, though members of the town's Board of Selectmen won't vote on the matter until the 2017 holiday has passed. Advocates for the switch have also voiced the desire for the change in Santa Barbara, California, Silver City, New Mexico, and Miami County, Kansas, among other cities. Dove apologizes after body wash ad is slammed for being racist. By Casey Quackenbush. Dove apologized Saturday following outcry over an ad it published to Facebook that many consider to be racist. The ad is a 3-second GIF that promotes Dove's body wash and shows a black woman peeling off a dark shirt and transforming into a white woman in a beige shirt. The white woman peels off her shirt to reveal another woman. An image we recently posted on Facebook missed the mark in representing women of color thoughtfully. "We deeply regret the offense it caused," Dove, which is owned by Unilever, tweeted. The offending ad has been removed. According to The Guardian, American makeup artist Naomi Blake took screenshots of the ad and shared them, commenting, "So I'm scrolling through Facebook and this is the hashtag Dove ad that comes up. Okay, so what am I looking at?" The response from those on social media was swift and damning, with many questioning why Dove would feature the dark-skinned woman first. "The message conveyed to me was that the black woman is dirty, and once you use Dove soap, you'll be clean and white," one commenter said on Facebook. Ava DuVernay, an award-winning African-American film director, denounced Dove, writing on Twitter, "You can do better than miss the mark. Flip plus diminishing. Deepens your offense. You do good work, have been for years. Do better here." The company issued a separate statement Sunday saying the ad did not represent the diversity of real beauty, which is something Dove is passionate about and is core to our beliefs, and it should not have happened. "We apologize deeply and sincerely for the offense it's caused and do not condone any activity or imagery that insults any audience." For many, the apology did not suffice, with consumers dumbfounded as to how the ad ever got the go-ahead. In a tweet that received more than 13,000 likes, one user said, "LOL, did this even look right to y'all? I mean, your whole team sat down and cleared this bullshit right here. How?" In 2011, Dove came under fire for its Visible Care product. In that campaign, 3 women, one black, one Latina, and one white, stood in front of before and after signs to promote body wash. Las Vegas shooter's behavior raised some red flags, casino magnate Steve Wynn says. But he admitted Paddock appeared rational on paper. By Alana Abramson. Casino magnate Steve Wynn said Sunday that even though Las Vegas shooter Stephen Paddock seemed like a rational man, some of his actions would have raised red flags at his properties. Wynn, the CEO of Wynn Resorts, which owns several hotels in Las Vegas, said at his properties an investigation is launched if someone puts "Do Not Disturb" on a room for at least 12 hours. The scenario that we're aware of would have indicated that he didn't let anyone in the room for 2 or 3 days. That would have triggered a whole bunch of alarms here, Wynn told Fox News' Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday. And we would have, on behalf of the guests, of course, investigated for safety, and it would have been a provocative situation. I'm sure that the same is true in other hotels, but in this hotel, a 36-hour, a 24-hour, 36-hour do not disturb on a room is a predicate for investigation. He's also been in the process of bolstering the security measures at his properties, a process Wynn said he started nearly 2 years ago when he realized Las Vegas could become a target of some kind of attack. Part of that beefed-up security protocol includes routine checks for weapons. Wynn said any visitor found carrying a gun is removed from his property. But Wynn acknowledged that Paddock did not publicly display any alarming issues or fit the profile of a compulsive gambler, admitting that he would not have thought to stop Paddock from staying at one of his hotels. The most vanilla profile one could possibly imagine, Wynn said. A modest gambler, at least by our standards, you know, nothing serious, paid promptly, never owed any money anywhere in Las Vegas. On October 1st, 64-year-old Paddock opened fire on the crowd attending the Route 91 Harvest Festival in Las Vegas. The shots fired from the 32nd floor of his hotel room at the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino killed 58 people and injured more than 500 others. Authorities subsequently discovered more than a dozen guns in his hotel room. MGM International, which owns Mandalay Bay, lost almost $1 billion the day of the shooting after shares of the company fell nearly 5%. Authorities have yet to publicly identify a motive for Paddock's desire to open fire. Wynn, noting the discrepancy between Paddock's outward rational behavior and the decision to commit a mass shooting, said he thinks Paddock was either demented or was trying to send a message. We don't know what that message is or if there is one, but this behavior, according to my employees, is as stunning, as unexpected as anybody any of them have ever met, he said. Vice President Mike Pence leaves football game after players kneel during national anthem. By Alana Abramson. Vice President Mike Pence left a football game in Indiana Sunday after players from the San Francisco 49ers reportedly knelt during the national anthem. President Trump and I will not dignify any event that disrespects our soldiers, our flag, or our national anthem, Pence said in a series of tweets. While everyone is entitled to their own opinion, I don't think it's too much to ask NFL players to respect the flag and our national anthem. Pence, the former governor of Indiana, was attending a game of the Indianapolis Colts, who were playing a home game against the San Francisco 49ers, Colin Kaepernick's former team. It appeared only members of the 49ers knelt during the anthem, not the Colts, according to the Indianapolis Star. Pence pointed this discrepancy out in a tweet, posting a picture of himself and his wife Karen standing during the anthem and writing, "We were proud to stand with all our Colts for our soldiers, our flag, and our national anthem." Last year, Kaepernick, who was playing as a quarterback for the 49ers at the time, routinely knelt during the national anthem as a silent protest against racial injustice in America. Kaepernick's protest morphed into a kneeling movement last month after President Donald Trump sparked controversy when he referred to NFL players who took a knee during the anthem as sons of bitches during a campaign rally in Alabama. More than 100 NFL players and owners linked arms and knelt before and during the anthem following Trump's attack. Trump said in a tweet that he had asked Pence to leave the stadium if any players kneeled during the national anthem, claiming such actions were disrespectful. "I asked Vice President Pence to leave stadium if any players kneeled, disrespecting our country. I am proud of him and Second Lady Karen," Trump tweeted. The Surprising Reason You Should Stop Skipping Breakfast, by Amanda McMillan. People who skip breakfast are more likely to have dangerous plaque buildup in their arteries, which puts them at increased risk for cardiovascular disease, according to a new study. Skipping breakfast has been associated with being heavier and having higher cholesterol levels. But the new study published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology linked it to the early stages of atherosclerosis, or the hardening and narrowing of arteries. For the study, researchers analyzed dietary data for more than 4,000 men and women ages 40 to 54 living in Spain. The people were then split into three groups based on how many calories they had for their morning meal, less than 5%, between 5 and 20%, or more than 20%. Only about 3% of people fell into the first category, meaning they skipped breakfast entirely and only had coffee, juice, or another beverage. The majority, about 69%, ate low-calorie breakfasts like toast or small pastries, while the remaining 28% ate larger, substantial meals. The researchers didn't further analyze each group's breakfast breakdown, but it's likely that the larger meals most closely represented what nutrition experts generally recommend for the first meal of the day. More whole grains, protein, healthy fats and fruits, and fewer refined grains and added sugars. Being in the first two categories, either skipping or skimping on breakfast, was associated with several risk factors for heart disease. People who ate less than 5% of their daily calories at breakfast were 2.5 times as likely to have generalized atherosclerosis, meaning their arteries had early signs of plaque in different locations compared with those who ate the largest breakfasts. Those who had low-calorie breakfasts were at increased risk for early signs of plaque in their arteries as well. On average, people who skipped breakfast also had the greatest waist circumference and highest body mass index, blood pressure, cholesterol, and fasting glucose levels. The study could not show a cause and effect relationship between skipping breakfast and any of these measures. In fact, the authors point out that people who skipped breakfast also tended to have more unhealthy lifestyles overall, including poor diets, frequent alcohol consumption, and smoking. They were also more likely to be overweight or obese, so it's possible that they didn't eat breakfast as a strategy to lose weight. But even when the authors adjusted for age, gender, smoking, drinking, cholesterol levels, waist circumference, and daily intake of red meat and salt, the associations between breakfast skipping and plaque remained, suggesting that indeed skipping breakfast could be one of the risk factors clustering around the onset and development of atherosclerosis, the authors wrote in their paper. In an accompanying editorial, researchers from the University of California, San Francisco, and the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute wrote that skipping breakfast can cause hormonal imbalances and alter circadian rhythms, and that it can also contribute to people eating more calories and more unhealthy foods later in the day. The important message of this study, as pointed out by the authors, is that skipping breakfast serves as a marker of poor dietary and lifestyle choices that are linked to subclinical atherosclerosis, they wrote in the paper. The editorial authors write that educating the public about simple lifestyle changes, including an emphasis on a regular, hearty, and nutritious breakfast, can help curb the oncoming tsunami of diabetes and cardiovascular disorders. Indeed, the wisdom of the ages that breakfast is the most important meal of the day has been proven right in the light of emerging evidence, they concluded.
White House releases list of hardline immigration demands in exchange for DACA support. By Jill Colvin. The Trump administration released a list of hardline immigration priorities on Sunday that threatened to derail efforts to protect from deportation hundreds of thousands of young immigrants, many of whom were brought into the U.S. illegally as children. The demands include overhauling the country's green card system, hiring 10,000 more immigration officers, and building President Donald Trump's promised wall along the southern border. Many are policies Democrats have explicitly said are off the table. But Trump administration officials said the president will insist on their passage in exchange for supporting legislation that would extend the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. These priorities are essential to mitigate the legal and economic consequences of any grants or status to DACA recipients, White House Legislative Affairs Director Mark Short told reporters. We're asking that these reforms be included in any legislation concerning the status of DACA recipients. Initiated under President Barack Obama, DACA protected hundreds of thousands of young people from deportation and allowed them to continue working legally in the U.S. Trump announced a phase-out of the program last month, but he has given Congress 6 months to come up with a legislative fix. Included on the list of demands, limiting family-based green cards to spouses and the minor children of U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents, and creating a point-based system. The White House also said it wants to boost fees at border crossings, make it easier to deport gang members and unaccompanied children, and overhaul the asylum system. And it wants new measures to crack down on sanctuary cities, which don't share information with federal immigration authorities, among other proposals. Democrats vehemently oppose many of the demands laid out in the administration list. In a joint statement, House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi and Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer said the list goes so far beyond what is reasonable and fails to represent any attempt at compromise. The administration can't be serious about compromise or helping the Dreamers if they begin with a list that is anathema to the Dreamers, to the immigrant community, and to the vast majority of Americans, they wrote. If the president was serious about protecting the Dreamers, his staff has not made a good faith effort to do so, they said. Representative Joaquin Castro, Democrat, Texas, accused the administration of trying to use Dreamers as bargaining chips to achieve the administration's deportation and detention goals. Congress should reject this warped anti-immigrant policy wish list, he said, adding, immigrants are humans. We should craft policies that treat them as such. House Speaker Paul Ryan spokesman Doug Andrus said the House Immigration Working Group will review the list and consult with Republican members and the administration.
Three of Steven Spielberg's biggest failures, according to Steven Spielberg, by Eliza Berman. Steven Spielberg doesn't do many interviews. For one thing, he's famously shy. For another, as the highest-grossing director in history, he doesn't have to. So fans hungry for insights from the storied filmmaker, now 70, might just consider the new documentary Spielberg, for which he gave more than 30 hours of interviews, something like The Ark of the Covenant, The Holy Grail, and the Sankara Stones all rolled into one. But the film, which premieres at the New York Film Festival October 5th and on HBO October 7th, may be an even worthier expenditure of 2.5 hours for the casual Spielberg fan, the one who grew up taking his prolific output as a given or even dismissed his populist sensibility. Directed by Susan Lacy, creator of PBS's Emmy-winning American Master series, the documentary explores the forces that shape the director of Jaws, E.T., and Jurassic Park. His suburban upbringing, his parents' divorce, his Jewish identity, and his innate fluency in the language of cinema. As Lacey recently told the New York Times, her objective was to demonstrate how, contrary to popular belief, Spielberg is an immensely personal director. In addition to the participation of its subject, talking heads include critics, scores of actors who have worked with him, from Leonardo DiCaprio and Daniel Day-Lewis to Oprah and Drew Barrymore, and fellow directors including four, Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, Brian De Palma, and George Lucas, with whom he came of age as a young filmmaker. Spielberg's career is, of course, defined by his successes. The 36 or so films he's directed, he's produced nearly twice as many, have earned him 3 Oscars and 13 additional nominations. They've taken in nearly $4.5 billion. He has been feted by the Kennedy Center honors and with a Presidential Medal of Freedom. But he's also had a few close encounters with failure. As Spielberg tells his own story, and, of course, as Lacey has edited it down for our consumption, here are 3 movies which brought about some of the more challenging moments in his long career. 1941. It was like I had committed a war crime. This is how Spielberg recalls the reception of his 1979 comedy, 1941, written by future Back to the Future scribes Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale. The movie stars John Belushi, John Candy, and Dan Aykroyd, and takes place during the chaos following the attack on Pearl Harbor. On the heels of Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, both of which went significantly over budget and over schedule but met with huge success, Spielberg says he had felt invulnerable. The movie wasn't a complete failure. It didn't flop horribly at the box office, and it managed to garner Oscar nods for visual effects, sound, and cinematography. But Spielberg was devastated by reviews. Like Times, which lamented its lack of spontaneity and overblown premise, it didn't help that all this criticism was being heaped onto a movie whose budget was more than triple that of Jaws, whose overwhelming returns had been something of a free pass to make whatever he wanted next. He stuck his head in a hole for a year, but his return would swiftly redeem him. In 1981, he introduced the world to an archaeology professor named Indiana Jones. The Color Purple. On its face, The Color Purple was not a defeat for Spielberg. It made nearly $100 million at the box office and earned 11 Oscar nominations, though no wins. But according to the director, his 1985 drama was more a miscalculation of execution. He was about to turn 40 and looking to stretch himself with a more mature story. But where its source material, Alice Walker's epistolary novel about black women living in the South in the 1930s, is gritty and raw, Spielberg's adaptation trends towards soft and pretty. "I was timid. I was just a little embarrassed," he concedes in the documentary, recalling scenes from the book. A love scene between two women and the scene in which a character observes her vagina in the mirror, which he chose to exclude. As Times film critic Richard Corliss wrote in his review, Spielberg has chosen to elegize the story by romanticizing it, swathing the characters in Norman Rockwell attitudes, a meddlesome symphonic score and a golden fairy dust that shines through the windows like God's blessing. If there is one thing the documentary's talking heads agree on, it's that Spielberg is unapologetically sentimental. But while it's invited some derision, this tendency also has more than a little to do with just how beloved his most beloved films came to be. Empire of the Sun. Failure is, perhaps, too strong a word to encapsulate Spielberg's recollection of his 1987 World War II drama starring a young Christian Bale. Next to his debut feature, The Sugarland Express, it's his lowest-grossing film, though to judge it by its box office is to miss what he was going for. In the documentary, screenwriter Tom Stoppard calls it the end of the innocence of Spielberg. Though it's told from a child's perspective and emanates Spielbergian sentiment, it's ultimately one of his bleakest. Summarizing its reception, New York Times critic A.O. Scott says that many critics at the time saw the film as Mr. Blockbuster suddenly trying to be serious. The director who, by Corliss's estimation, had taken out a patent on perennial childhood, was asking audiences to allow him the opportunity to grow up on screen. And not everyone has prepared to allow it. His feelings were hurt by the response, which producer Kathleen Kennedy says amounted more or less to a collective, "How dare you?" But time has been kinder to the movie, which many now consider to be among his more accomplished efforts. After all, some of Spielberg's biggest risks have yielded some of his greatest triumphs. The vastly different but historic cinematic events that were Jurassic Park, 1993, and Schindler's List, 1994, may seem like a given today, but a movie starring 60-foot computer-generated dinosaurs followed by a 3-hour-plus black-and-white film about the Holocaust were anything but when he embarked on them, one after the other. In those victories, it becomes clear that Spielberg's alignment with the mainstream has fueled perhaps one of the biggest misconceptions about his career. Call his movies popular, call them sentimental. Just don't call them safe. This article is published on Time.com by Eliza Berman. How I Finally Stopped Micromanaging My Team by Kristen Hadid. No more protecting anyone from making mistakes. It had been about 2 years since I graduated from college, and I still hadn't taken a real vacation. Being in constant work mode running my startup, Student Made, had become my new normal. I'd forgotten what it felt like to take some time for myself. I finally hit a breaking point and told managers Aaron and Abby I needed to get away, and thankfully they agreed to hold down the fort. Before I left, I made them the list of all lists. I thought of every potential situation that might occur while I was gone and spelled out exactly how to handle each one. I could practically taste the room service I would soon be ordering from my hotel bed. By 10 a.m. the morning of my trip, I was all checked in and sitting at my gate. I stared at my phone while I waited for my zone to be announced. No missed calls, no texts, no emails. I took a deep, relaxing breath as I thought about all the sleeping in I'd be doing over the next 3 days. And then, mid-breath, the gravity of the situation hit me like a bucket of cold, soapy mop water. This would be the first time I was leaving Student Made in someone else's care for an extended period of time. And I wouldn't be able to get back in an hour or two if there was a problem. Anxious thoughts stayed with me as I boarded the plane. By the time we touched down in Atlanta for my layover, I was kind of freaking out. I turned my phone back on. No texts, no voicemails. I opened my email, holding my phone at arm's length and wincing as I waited for the app to load. Something bad was definitely going to be in there. I was sure of it. But still, nothing. Then, just as I was shoving my briefcase into the overhead compartment on my next flight, I felt my phone vibrate in my back pocket. Uh-oh. I pulled it out and saw a text from Abby. Shepherd's pie. Call ASAP. Oh no. No, 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 no. To the rest of the world, shepherd's pie is a traditional English dish of meat and potatoes. But to Aaron, Abby, and me, shepherd's pie was a code that meant something was going horribly wrong at Student Made. How do we choose that phrase in particular? No clue. The rules were very simple. If I ever got a text from one of them containing the words shepherd's pie, I had to drop everything, no matter where I was or what I was doing, and call them. I thought about the other times Aaron and Abby had used the code in the past. They'd use it once when the bin of microfiber rags caught fire spontaneously. Never knew that could happen. And again, when the client was so upset with spilled bleach on her designer rug that she threatened to sue us. Each time I'd come to the rescue. I need to get off this plane, I thought, right now. My phone vibrated again. This time Aaron was calling me. I knew whatever was going on back at the office had to be bad. As I was about to answer Aaron's call, the flight attendant walked over and sternly told me to put my phone in airplane mode, then lingered nearby to make sure I did. There was nothing I could do. I turned the phone off, tightened my seatbelt, and grabbed a barf bag. By the time the plane started its descent, I was absolutely certain Student Made was in ruins. But as I turned on my phone and scrolled through the many texts from Aaron and Abby, an amazing thing happened. The tone of the messages changed. They went from screaming, shepherd's pie, and need you now, to everything is okay, we figured it out, and even a smiley face. Turns out a student had slipped and fallen in a client garage. Even though she was a little banged up, she didn't want to go to the clinic and get medical treatment through a workers' comp coverage. She insisted she was okay, but Aaron and Abby weren't convinced. I'd briefed them on what to do if someone got hurt on the job, of course, but never taught them what to do if someone refused help after getting injured. Once they realized I wasn't calling them back, they got in touch with our insurance company to go over what they needed to do legally to ensure they didn't make the situation any worse. Then they explained every option available to the student as thoroughly as possible until they were sure she was completely okay with her choice to refuse treatment. They got her refusal in writing and sent off the necessary paperwork to the workers' comp people. And that was it. They didn't need me. At all. I wouldn't even have known what to do in that situation. For the first time since they'd started as student maid, Aaron and Abby had no choice but to rely on themselves and their own thinking. So they did. They had all the smarts they needed to find the answers. They always had. It's why I hired them in the first place. The missing piece was opportunity. I was the one who had been getting in their way. Up until that point, when things got tough, all they had to do was say a code word and I'd hop in my helicopter and zoom right over. When Aaron and Abby told me the story of how they'd solved their own shepherd's pie crisis, I could feel their pride through the phone. I realized they were proud because they had found the solution and got to take credit for it instead of acting on my orders. When I returned from my trip, I reminded myself to step back and let them step up more often. I did away with the detailed to-do lists and made it their responsibility to figure things out and handle predicaments as they arose. The more I got out of their way, the more independent and confident they both became. They called me less and less, and I finally felt like I didn't have to carry everything on my shoulders, or in my briefcase. I don't remember getting another shepherd's pie message after that. Seeing how much Aaron and Abby had grown made me want everyone as student maid to experience that kind of self-reliance and the satisfaction that came along with it. And that meant no more protecting anyone from making mistakes. It meant keeping my helicopter grounded. It became my mission to make Student Maid a place where people had room to screw up and to figure things out on their own without having to worry about losing their jobs in the process. I figured that if I succeeded, it would be a win for all of us. Our student workers would gain problem-solving skills that would help them thrive not only in their jobs as student maid, but also in their future pursuits. They would learn to trust themselves and become more independent. And they'd be able to take pride in their accomplishments. Even when they messed up, they'd learn something. I knew they all could bounce back. In the end, I'd get a stronger, more reliable team and much more relaxing vacations. Excerpted from Permission to Screw Up, How I Learned to Lead by Doing Almost Everything Wrong, by Kristen Hadid, in agreement with Portfolio, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House LLC. Copyright Kristen Hadid, 2017.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.